Certainly a pleasure for me to have this privilege to be here with you this morning. It's a joy once again to be here at Mount Carmel Road, and it's an honor to have been asked by you to speak not only this morning but this entire week on what I think is an extremely interesting and very vital subject for our consideration. So thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for being here, and thank you for the interest you've expressed in so many places in recent weeks and several months now, as you've gone from time to time and place to place to be with us at other places. Brethren have been very encouraged by your presence and appreciate so much the effort that you have put forth in being such a cooperative spirit here in this general area of the Southeast. You've done a marvelous work, and we're proud and thankful for it. You've asked me to speak on the subject of Daniel, Book of Revelation. These books are extremely interesting books. They are also very, very informative books, and they're books that quite often are avoided by our brethren in studying. And the reason, I think, is because they are difficult books. They are very deep books. They're complicated in many ways. And one thing, and I say this critically, but I don't mean it to be in a bad way, is that so many people don't want to take the time to study. And consequently, they don't want to take the time or the effort to put forth to really go into detail about these books. Because they do take a lot of study, a lot of time, a lot of work, a lot of investigation to understand what they're all about. So quite often when we study the Bible, we start with the book of Matthew, and we go through the entire New Testament, the book of Jude, and all of a sudden somebody says, well, nobody can understand Revelation anyway. Let's just go back to Matthew and start over again. And that never gets the job done. It's been done in a number of places by a number of brethren. I hope you haven't been inclined that way, and I say you haven't, of course, at this time because you've asked to talk on it. But these books are not only interesting and they're not only informative, but I think they're essential to our real complete understanding of what the Bible is all about. Now, there's been some statements made that we don't have to completely understand prophecy to be saved, and that's true. There are many things about prophecy that we may not ever understand until the time comes for them to be fulfilled. And many, many people for the past 4,000 years have died without completely understanding Revelation or even the book of Daniel. So certainly it's true we do not have to understand completely all of prophecy to be saved, because many things in prophecy may not have come about yet by the time we were living. But the fact is, prophecy gives us a beautiful insight onto matters the Lord has in mind and that are going to come about. And all of prophecy has to do with the encouragement of God's people. Now, we're going to read some things in Daniel, and particularly in Revelation, that are not going to seem very pleasant. They're going to seem to be very rude and very sad. They're going to seem to be items of discussion about problems and difficulties and killings and bloodshed and wars and things of that kind in its concept. But don't worry about those things. And the reason I say this is because these books are given to encourage us, to give us insight, and not for a moment to scare us. The things in Daniel and Revelation that seem to be so horrible are not at all aimed at God's people, but they're trying to inform God's people of what's going to happen to the world around us that are not Christians. So these books are not for a moment scary books. They're books of encouragement. They're books that give us enlightenment. They're books that should encourage us in knowing where we stand, and encourage us to continue the Christian walk of life. Now, time serves as a very exact and a very unyielding judge of those who would presume to study prophecy. Time is a very central element in prophecy. And if we are mistaken, time's going to point that out. And if we're correct, time's going to point it out too. And here's the reason why. Prophecy, to define it as it really is, prophecy is history written before it ever occurred. And history is a record of what has happened. So then, this is our procedure. Prophecy is a record that God has written ahead of time, telling us what was going to happen. Then history, being a record of what has happened, if we lay it side by side with prophecy, then history will interpret prophecy. So then, if you find out what God said would happen, and history, even written by worldly men, tell us what did happen, and they coincide, then we can say a beautiful, beautiful picture that proves, first of all, that God knew what was going to happen, and that God is God who wrote the Bible. The Bible is absolutely true, because those of the world around us, secular historians, who are not even members of the Lord's church, in many cases not even believers in God, they have written records that sustain and prove what the Bible said to be true was true. So the study of prophecy then is a very interesting study because it not only confirms the Bible, it gives us insight onto what was going to occur. As we approach prophecy, I want to, first of all, go into some matters to let us see a setting of where we are. And I think this will help a great deal to lay a foundation for us to build upon in our study. Of course, I don't think we can start any earlier than creation, so we'll start off with Adam. Adam and Eve, as you recall, were the first of beings in this world. And the Bible tells us that Adam was created by God, and God in the meantime saw fit to give him a companion. And that companion, of course, Eve, began to have sons and daughters, the Bible tells us. In the meantime, we come down the scheme of time for 10 generations to a man whose name was Noah. You remember now that Noah was God's person he would use because he was the one man who had faith in God and trusted God, and God saw fit that he was a righteous person. God saw fit to save the entire world by means of Noah and his obedience to God. So he built an ark. That ark, as God commanded him to build, was able to sustain God's plans and purposes for the world. And so Noah then was the 10th generation from the time of Adam. Now we come on down 10 more generations to a man whose name was Terah. Now Terah makes the 20th generation from the time of Adam. Now Abraham is the son of Terah. Abraham comes on the scene next then, and we find that Abraham was a man also like Noah who feared God and served God. God saw fit to kill through Abraham the entire world that was going to come a Savior down through the stream of time. In the book of Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 through 2, 1 and 2, the Bible tells us that Abraham is told that down through the scheme of time, there's going to come one through your line of descent, and this one is going to become the Messiah. He's going to save the entire world. Abraham is also told, not only is the Messiah going to come through you, at the same time, through your same line of descent, there's going to come a great nation. This nation is going to be a nation that I'm going to work with, I'm going to provide for, I'm going to give them a land, and they're going to inhabit that land, become a mighty nation. And from this nation will emerge this Messiah I've been telling you about. You find this recorded, of course, in Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 18, Genesis 21, and a number of different other places where you find where God has repeated this message, but primarily in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 through 2. Now, the Bible tells us that Abraham and Sarah, his wife, could not have children properly until they were very, very old. In fact, when Abraham was 100 years old and his wife Sarah was 90, at that time they had their first child. In the meantime, God had waited so long to bring about this child, as you know the story, that Sarah saw fit to try to help God out. Now, we learn, first of all, a very good lesson right here. You don't help God because God does not need help. If he needed help, he wouldn't be God, would he? And so we find here that Sarah tried to help God by saying, Abraham, since I can't have children, I haven't had children, God said I would have and I haven't had yet, then you go into my handmaid and have a child by her. And this will be that son God has promised. Well, of course, that didn't work. And sure enough, he had a child. And sure enough, that fit the plan that Sarah had, except for the fact that was not pleasing to God. Now, from that time, we go into a situation that you're reading about every day in the newspaper and seeing about every day on television, the conflict in the Middle East. It's gone on now for 4,000 years, and I see no end in sight for it. It started back when Sarah made a mistake. Let's see what happened. The Bible tells us that Sarah had the child. This child, Sarah's handmaiden, Hagar, had the child. And this child was born one whose name was Ishmael. And Ishmael was born 14 years before. Sarah indeed had a child herself, and this child was named Isaac. So we have now two children. One who is really Abraham's son, but not Sarah's. One who is both Sarah and Abraham's son. This is the son of promise. And this is the one God says through whom the promise is going to come that the Messiah will enter into the world. In the meantime, Ishmael now has also sons. The Bible tells us that he has 12 sons. Now, these 12 sons become what you know of today in the world as Arabs. These are the ones who were the forefathers of the Arab nations you see in the world today. It was through this line of descent that Mohammed came on the scene in the 500s. And from that time on, we've had all kind of trouble in a religious sense. But the trouble started here between the conflict because when Sarah had Isaac as her son, And then Sarah became very jealous of what was happening over here with Hagar's son, Ishmael. And so Sarah said, you get rid of this woman and her child. And of course, Abraham, even though he was reluctant to do so, he did that very thing. So he sent Ishmael and his mother out to the wilderness. And eventually they had these 12 sons I mentioned to you, became the Arabs. In the meantime, the Bible tells us that Isaac had a son whose name was Jacob. Now Jacob, in the meantime, also had 12 sons. Now these 12 sons became known of later on as the children of Israel. The reason why is because God changed Jacob's name to Israel. So that's where now we read of Israel and the Arabs in the conflict. In the meantime, the Bible tells us that these 12 tribes were divided into 12 basic sections of the land, and they began to live there and did live there for quite some several hundreds of years. God blessed them and become his people. And they had eventually divided into a number of sections the Bible speaks about that we won't go into much in detail tonight or today, but except for this fact, there were 12 sons born to Israel. Now the Bible tells us that these sons are predicted as to what would happen to them in the book of Genesis chapter 49 and 50. We find this written. Now this son right here was named Levi. Now Levi was to become the priest. He was the one that would offer the sacrifices God would work through because he was this chosen one. Technically, there were 13 tribes. The reason why is because this son right here, Joseph, was so faithful to God that God saw fit to let him have a double inheritance rather than just one. So technically, there were 13 tribes when you consider Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. In the meantime, however, God selected Levi to be the tribe of the priest. And so he removed this tribe from the 13 in the sense he made a special tribe out of it. So there were still 12 land divisions, and the priest mingled among all the other people and served them as priests. So really we have 12 land divisions. In the meantime then, the Bible tells us this person right here was named Judah. Now God told Judah through Israel speaking to him in Genesis 49 that you are the one through whom God's going to bring the Messiah. He says, now the kingship line will never depart from you until the Messiah comes on the scene. Now that's a promise given way back in the past, but we find that was soon fulfilled as time unfolded and generations came on. Now let's see if I can erase what I have on the board here a moment, because I want a little bit more time, more space than I have here. Remember now, what we're talking about is an descent from Adam all the way down through Abraham, and the promise given to Abraham that he would have this Messiah that come in the world was given in 1926 B.C. You can say the year 2000 if you want to and come pretty well close to it. In the meantime, we're talking about that promise given to Abraham, and Abraham's children come on the scene, his grandchildren come on the scene, and so now Israel is divided into 12 sections, and the land of Canaan becomes the land of promise, the land of Israel, and God's people are living there. God allows these people to be able to enjoy the land, but also to be ruled, in a sense, by means of judges. Now, the judges were people who God would raise up at any time he saw fit to when there was a need for them to be raised up. For example, there was not a central headquarters. There was not a central king. But God raised up a man over in this tribe when he saw that there needed to be one raised. And that man would serve for a period of time until he died. Then there'd be no judge because there's no need for one. Until finally a problem arose, perhaps up in Dan, where in the north, God would raise a prophet up there. And he would live and serve until he died. And then there would be no judge until a problem arose somewhere else. There were 14 judges in all. One, in fact, was a woman. So this continued for some time until finally the time of Samuel, the people decided we don't want to continue God's plan anymore. And we want to be like the nations round about us. So we want a king to go in and out among us like the kings of the world around us. And that's what we desire to have. Well, Samuel went to God and God said, no, that's not my will. But the people are insistent. He said, go ahead, even though it's contrary to my will, my plan, and I don't want it that way. Let the people have a king. But warn them, the kind of king they're going to have is not one they want. He'll take their daughters and make them confessionaries. He'll take their sons and put them in his operation, his service. He'll take their horses and put in his stables. The fact is, you won't want this king once you get it. But they said, nonetheless, we will have a king to be like the nations round about us. And so, sure enough, there came on the scene a man whose name was Saul. Now, Saul was the first king of Israel. He was a fine king to start with. He was a very large man. In fact, from his shoulders to the top of his head, he was higher than anybody else in Israel. Very huge man. And he was a good man to start with. But finally, he began to be lifted up with pride. He began to be a jealous person. And he was from the tribe of Benjamin. So God allowed Benjamin to have the first king. In the meantime, his son-in-law named David came on the scene at Saul's death. And David now becomes the king of Israel. And sure enough, as was predicted back in Genesis chapter 49, he was from the tribe of Judah. Now notice, Genesis 49 tells us that until Christ comes, that the kingship line will always be from the tribe of Judah. So the first king, Benjamin, but from there on, the tribe of Judah. That's the way it should have been. That's the way God intended for it to be, and that's the way it was with God's favor. In the meantime, David passed on after 40 years, and the Bible tells us that Solomon came on the scene as his son and began to reign. Well, when Solomon reigned for 40 years, this is 120 years of the first three kings, then Solomon died, and there was a man who was born to him. His name was Rehoboam. He was the rightful king and should have remained the rightful king of Israel. But at the same time, there was a man too who rose and wanted to be king. His name was Jeroboam. Now, he was not the rightful king, should not have been king, had no right to be king. Rehoboam was the proper king. But Rehoboam didn't please the people. He didn't act wisely. And so most of the people followed Jeroboam. So the fact is then that 10 of the tribes of Israel followed Jeroboam to the north. And they took the name then in the north as Israel. That's the old name of the people of God, but they took that name. In the meantime, Rehoboam was a man who had the power and influence over two tribes, and the major tribe was Judah. And Benjamin went with Judah, and they became known then as Judah. So we have two sections of Israel now. We have Judah, which is a proper section that follows a proper king, and Israel, who rebelled, and in the northern 10 kingdoms, they decided they would become separate from the southern two kingdoms, and consequently, there was a division made that never was healed at all, and finally, these people here became annihilated, and we lose track of them. Now, this continued on for a while, having conflict between themselves and others around them too, until finally, this northern 10 kingdom was defeated in 721 by the Assyrians. Now, we're going to talk about this much, much more in Revelation. We're not there yet. Of course, in the future, we'll come back to it. But in 721 B.C., this section of the 10 tribes of the north were defeated. There was among them 9 dynasties, which means, of course, 9 different families who ruled, and there were 19 kings in this particular section. Came to an end in 721 by Assyria conquering them. In the meantime, Judah, the rightful kingdom of God, continued until 587. Now, in 587, we find that they had 20 kings. They had only one dynasty because, of course, they stayed as the children of Judah. So we have this two division section of Israel that continues now until 587. Now, that briefly is the story that we're talking about up to the present time. We turn to the book of Daniel. In Daniel now, 721 is the time at which the northern 10 tribes have been taken away captive. We never hear them again. They disappear. They're mingling among the Gentiles. But in 587, Babylon now comes on the scene, succeeding as a world kingdom, Assyria. Babylon comes on the scene now, and they come in and conquer Jerusalem and destroy it and take away the people of Israel 70 years into the land of Babylon. Now, that's where our story starts now in the book of Daniel, chapter 1. If we turn out of chapter 1 in Daniel and continue reading, we notice that the kings, the last few kings, were first of all Hezekiah. He ruled in 726. Following him was Manasseh in 697. Following him was Amon in 642. Followed by Josiah in 640. And then Jehoahaz comes on the scene in 609. All these, of course, are B.C. I think I need to say, although it's probably not necessary, that when you talk on the other side of what we call the year zero, Later on, we'll explain that's not proper, but we'll use it right now because that lets us know what we're talking about. When you talk on the other side of the year zero, we call it B.C. Now, B.C. is a word that we use for before Christ. Those of the world around us who don't accept Christ won't use that term. They call it B.C.E., which means before the current era. They don't use the word Christ. And the Jews do the same thing. They won't use the word B.C., the words, the letters B.C. Anyway, before B.C., you have years going backward till about the beginning of time, which was around 4,000 B.C. And then from the time of A.D., which is Anno Domini, the year of our Lord, not after death. Anno Domini, you go in the other direction. So that today we call ourselves 2003, which would be extension from the 4,000 before that time. So now when you take in terms of these persons who lived and reigned back in those days, you come in descending order from, as I mentioned here, 726 down to 609. And that's where we find the man named Jehoahaz on the scene. He reigned for 3 months. He was replaced by Pharaoh in Egypt by his brother, whose name was Jehoiakim. Now Jehoiakim comes on the scene in 609. He reigns for 3 years, at which time Nebuchadnezzar, who is the king of Babylon now, he just become king. His father has let the throne go over to him. So he comes down from Babylon, and he invades the area we know of as the Holy Land and Jerusalem. Now let me explain to you where Nebuchadnezzar is from. On your television sets and newsreels and also newspapers, you've been seeing Iraq. By the way, I was over there some time ago, and I used the name Iraq. They didn't understand me. I used the name Iran, and they could understand me. They said, what are you talking about? They don't call it Iraq and Iran, as our news commentators do. It's Iraq and Iran. They pronounce the I as an E. So that's the proper pronunciation. So Iraq is where we're talking about, which is Babylon. And Iran is Persia, which we'll read about later on. So even though you're seeing those things in our newspapers today, in our television programs today, these times go way back in the past, in the ancient era. So Iran now is where we're talking about, where Nebuchadnezzar ruled from. He comes on the scene in 606 B.C. He invades Jerusalem and he conquers it. The Bible tells us of this, as we have read in a number of places, 2 Kings 24 and 2 Chronicles also, chapter 36. And this is the first invasion he makes. Now, at that invasion, he takes away some captivities, some into captivity from Jerusalem. Including in that number is one we're going to talk about this morning, and that's Daniel, as well as three of his companions. Now, to hasten our story a little bit, we're also going to find that he makes another invasion in 598. And in 598, he comes on the scene. He replaces the king who had reigned 3 years and 3 months rather than 10 days. And he places on the throne a king named Zedekiah. Now, these are all from the tribe of Judah, but he points them himself, and he makes a change there. And this becomes the second invasion. Now, on the second invasion he makes, he takes away some that you know of. He takes away Ezekiel. He takes away also Esther and her cousin Mordecai as captives. You read of this as the second invasion. Now, next invasion he makes is in 587. There he deposes Zedekiah. And he takes the city of Jerusalem, completely destroys it, takes away the inhabitants to his homeland of Babylon, and they stay there for 70 years. So that's basically the background of where we are as we turn now to the book of Daniel and begin to read. Daniel then, as a prophet who comes on the scene, as God intended for that to be done, and begins to unfold us for us some beautiful things that we're going to get into and find a lovely, lovely story that God has in mind. In the meantime, let me show you where the prophet served. Remember a while ago, I mentioned to you that Abraham had these two sons, and eventually he had Isaac and Jacob as his followers, and then the 12 tribes who came after Jacob. Now, the promise was that the Messiah would come down through the stream of time, and that's precisely what happened. In the meantime, though, God allowed Israel to come on the scene as a nation, and during this period of time is when the prophets arose. The prophets then serve the purpose before the Messiah comes as to letting us know when the Messiah is going to come, where he's going to come, what he's going to do, who he is, the family he comes from. And they explain in detail over and over and over again, here a little, there a little, of the coming of the Messiah. The prophets then serve in order to confirm what God had in mind, to let the world know about it so that when it occurs, we can prove indeed who emphatically is a prophet Messiah. Now, we're going to talk about that in Daniel chapter 9 in detail. And I think you'll be amazed at what Daniel knew 500 years before Jesus came on the scene. That's the head of our story. In the book of Daniel chapter 1 now, we notice that it's in the third year, as we have mentioned already, of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Nebuchadnezzar comes on the scene and conquers Israel. You read of this going to occur in Jeremiah chapter 25, Jeremiah chapter 27, and Jeremiah chapter 29. Three places in Jeremiah it's found, as well as mentioned also in other books too. Now, this beautiful reference to the era they're going to is found in the book of Psalms chapter 137, verse 1 and verse 9. Now, verse 1 of Psalms 137 says, they are in that land where they went to. And then the verse 8 tells us that Nebuchadnezzar and the power of Babylon is going to be lost, and the children of Israel are going to return to their homeland. Now, the prediction also is made in the book of 2 Kings and the book of Isaiah that the children of Israel are going to become, in effect, eunuchs to serve foreign kings. And this tells us all the 70 years in which they'll be under bondage and under a god of oppression from those who rule over them. The year, of course, is 606 B.C. Babylon is ruled by the king Nebuchadnezzar. He besieges and conquers Jerusalem. There are certain of Judah that remains there. And the second invasion that takes place, as I mentioned earlier, Daniel and his three companions, as well as others, no doubt. And then the third invasion allows us to see that some such as the entire remaining group is taken away. Made a mistake there. Daniel and his three companions take away in the first invasion. Then Esther and Ezekiel take away in the second invasion. And then the entire populace, except for a few stragglers, are not taken away until the third invasion. Now, during that third invasion, Jeremiah stays behind, and we lose track of him. We don't know what happened to him. We think he went to Egypt. The Bible seems to imply that, but we never hear of him after that time at all. And so we have a lot of desolation during these invasions we're reading about. Now, the Bible tells us in chapter 1 that Daniel, now being a young man and having his companions with him, are used to be trained and to be fed and to be reared under Nebuchadnezzar as young men who will be in positions of authority later on. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is very wise here, and the reason why is because when he brings these people who later on are going to be called Jews, when he brings them over to his land and he controls them and dominates over them, there's going to be rebellion, and there's going to be unrest, and then they're not going to be settled as they would like to be because they are under oppression. But if he allows these young men to be tutored and reared up, and they become the leaders of Israel, then they're going to be accepted much, much better, and they were. And so Daniel now is trained, and he's taught, and he's encouraged, as his companions are, of the learning of the Babylonians. Extremely good learning in a secular way. Now, he has put over him a man whose name is Aspenaz. Aspenaz is a servant of Babylonia, of Nebuchadnezzar. And he proceeds to feed Daniel and Daniel's companions with the food that is normally given to them. This is going to be for a three-year period. So they're going to eat and grow and prosper and learn during these 3 years. In the meantime, though, Daniel says, in effect, no, we can't do that. He says, in effect, we are Israelites, and we don't eat the same kind of food you do. In fact, it's an abomination to eat that. Those are my words, not Daniel. That's what he's saying, in effect, to Aspenaz. And Aspenaz fears because he realizes that Nebuchadnezzar is looking to him to raise these young men in a way they would fare well, and they would be presentable when the 3 years comes to an end. So he's afraid that if he doesn't do his job properly, then Nebuchadnezzar is going to take vengeance on him. But Daniel says, you give us 10 days, and you wait and see. You give us pulse to eat, and as we eat this, you're going to find out that we fare well, and we're going to look good and fair in such ways that you'll be well pleased with what we are. So we'll prove to you that what we're going to eat is going to be the proper after all. And so sure enough, Daniel has gained the favor of Aspenaz. Aspenaz listens to him and says, in effect, okay, you have these days to eat your own food and do as you wish. Now, what are they going to eat? Well, the Bible tells us in several places what this is. For one thing, those who have studied these words in the past, such as Strong, who's written about these and many other matters, has a dictionary on the Bible, says it means something that is grown, that is something that is such as a vegetable. Now, that's what he says, and of course, he is more modern in the time. But as we go back in the Old Testament, 2 Samuel chapter 17, verse 28 tells us there's something that's parched. So that, of course, would sustain the idea that it's a vegetable that was parched. So here we have now Daniel is going to eat vegetables. He's going to eat things that are permissible, that are pleasing in God's sight, and not eat contaminated meat, which the Jews should not eat. And so Daniel encourages his companions to eat that. They do eat it. And the Bible tells us then, of course, that these four children do prosper very, very greatly, verses 17 to verse 20. Daniel's service now continues, the Bible tells us, until in verse 21, the time of Cyrus the king of Persia. So Daniel now is a young man when he begins to take over the position. We read of him as a prophet of God, and he lives a very old age, even the time when Persia comes on the scene later on in history. So chapter 1 tells us of the beginning of the book of Daniel, of Daniel being one who is very wise, very humble, a young man at that time, who serves God in a very beautiful and very remarkable way, as the Bible tells us he did, and as we, of course, know from our study of the Bible in times past. Now we turn to chapter 2 very rapidly, and chapter 2 is a very, very important chapter. But as we turn to chapter 2, let me suggest to you this. Chapter 2 is not out of place at all. It's exactly where it should be. But chapter 1 gives us the introduction. Chapter 3, 4, 5, and 6 tell us of events that took place while Daniel lived and during the era of Daniel's tenure there. But chapter 2, not out of place, but chapter 2 gives us insight to the future that doesn't really have much to do except to tell what's going to happen to the next four kingdoms. And then chapter 7 through chapter 12 goes to the future and predicts things that we're going to talk about more detail later on today. So chapter 1 gives us introduction. Chapter 3, 4, 5, and 6 tells us of events taking place at that time while Daniel was living. Then chapter 2, chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 tell us of future events. Now chapter 2 gives us a layout, a very good foundation of what we're going to need as we turn to the New Testament to study it, and also as we turn to the book of Revelation and study it. The reason then we study Daniel is because even though it was written 500 years before Christ, it's a book that gives us a very good foundation to set the New Testament upon, that we can have a very good insight to the historical elements around it and be better prepared to go forward. Now chapter 2 tells us that Nebuchadnezzar is that king we've been speaking about. At that particular time, he's the greatest king in the world. He has domination over the land of Babylon, who is the greatest world power at that time. They defeated the Assyrians, and now they're the great world power that came on the scene. So Nebuchadnezzar now, as we quite often read about in the Bible, dreamed a dream. Now, that's not unusual to dream a dream. I had some last night. I guess some of you do all along. They don't make much sense to us, do they? Some of mine don't make a bit of sense in the world. Sometimes I wish I could dream just about three more minutes and find out what happened, but it doesn't happen. I've never been killed yet. I've almost been killed in a dream, but always stopped before I got killed. I don't know what would have happened. But anyway, those dreams to us are rather amusing and sometimes scary. But the fact is, they don't mean much to us today. But God back then used dreams to tell people our future events and to give them warnings. Time and time again, the Bible tells us about that. But Nebuchadnezzar now is dreaming a dream. Now, of course, it's not necessarily just for Nebuchadnezzar, but it's for you and me. So this dream was given so that you and I can understand a real beautiful truth that the entire rest of the New Testament, of the Old Testament and the New Testament, built upon. Here the Bible tells us that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed a dream of an awful image. This image was of what looks like a man, but this man is made up of minerals. Mineral is an element. If you put two of them together, you make a rock. But these minerals are separate. Now, the first is gold of the head, and the middle part of this man is silver. His breast and his arms are silver. And then the middle section is of brass, and then his legs and feet are of iron, with his toes of iron and clay mixed together. Now, this is the image that he sees in his dream, but not only does he see this, he doesn't really understand what's going on, and he forgets about it even. I think maybe we ought to be able to read this for ourselves, word from word, what the Bible says here about this. The dream of the king is lost. He doesn't know what it is. He can't remember it. So he calls in his soothsayers and his astrologers and men that we would call today fortune tellers, he calls them in to try to tell him not only what his dream meant, but also what you dreamed. He'd forgotten about it. Didn't understand what he had dreamed. He'd forgotten what it was. And so they said, we can't do it. That's not within the power of man. And so if you tell us what you did dream, then we'll tell you what it means. Well, Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't listen to that because he realized they were trying to pull his leg, so to speak. They were trying to find a room where they might give him something that the dream might have meant. And they could take something. But he recognized what they were. They were fakes, and he knew it, and he told them they were. He said, now, unless you tell me what my dream was and then what it meant, I'm going to kill you. And so they proceeded then to go out and find these soothsayers and magicians and astrologers and those who are supposed to tell such things and put them to death. Well, Daniel was involved in this group, and so they came to Daniel, and he hears now what the problem is. He says, now, hold on, don't be too hasty. He says, there is a God of heaven that can tell you these things. And so he sent word to Nebuchadnezzar, and he was very pleased to know there was somebody after all that could tell the dream. And so Daniel is brought before the king, and in beautiful terms, beautiful language, he explains to the king what happened. And so verse 25 of chapter 2 says, Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. And so the king now is pleased to hear that. He asks in verse 6, are you able to tell me? Notice what Daniel says in verse 27. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, show unto the king? He admits that. He makes it a positive statement. These men can't do what they say they can do. But, the next verse says, there's a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts that came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter. And in he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, he says, I'm just a man. The secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation of the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Then he says, thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, the brass in his arms of silver, belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image of his feet, that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken in pieces together. They came like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. We will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Now, this doesn't make much sense to us. That is, unless we know the rest of the story. But when we see the rest of the story, it makes a beautiful picture of what God had in mind. And he repeats it several times in Daniel. What we find is, as Daniel interpreted, is this. This great image, made up of metals, has this characteristic. It's made up, first of all, of gold, and then something inferior called silver, something inferior to that called brass, and then something less valuable called iron. But notice, if you would, as you have the value diminished in the monetary sense, then you have also the strength increased. Silver is stronger than gold. Brass is stronger than silver. Iron is stronger than brass. So as you see the glory and the magnificence of these kingdoms wane away, then you find the strength of them increase. And so finally then, at the last, you have a stone cut out without hands. Now who would it be who can cut a stone out without hands? Of course, Almighty God. Now this stone came and struck the image in the feet, and he completely destroyed this image. But this stone grew and prospered and became a great mountain in itself, and it continued forevermore. Now, that's the image we read about. As we continue on in our study, we notice here that he says, you, Nebuchadnezzar, are this great king of gold. You, Nebuchadnezzar, are the king of Babylon. So that first kingdom of gold is Babylon. Now there's going to be a kingdom after you that comes on the scene. That's going to be the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. The Medes and the Persians were separate people related. And eventually the Persians became more powerful than the Medes and took them over, and they became known as Persia after that. And then he says after them is going to rise another kingdom. The next kingdom on the scene is Greece. And after them a fourth kingdom. Now, this is what Daniel says, and this is in 500 B.C. Now, if you go into your library today, in the city or in your high schools, either one, sometime even in grade schools, you're going to find your history book, simply written, very, very simple language, tells you exactly this order that occurred. You see, Daniel said that these things are going to occur 500 years before they came on the scene. And the Bible tells us precisely what was going to happen. Your history book today, written by people who don't know a thing about Christ, have no respect for Christ at all, they'll tell you this is exactly in the order in which he came and give you the dates in which he came. So he's predicting then the kingdom that's going to come on the earth from the time of Babylon down to the time of the Roman Empire. And he does not tell us the name of the Roman Empire in this particular chapter, but later on we find who it is. Then he says in verse 44, and in the days of these kings, Babylon, Persia, Greece, now Rome. So in the days of these kings, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people. Now notice, Babylon was left to Persia. Persia was left to Greece. Greece was left to Rome. He said, now this kingdom that's going to be established, this rock that's going to be established, is not going to be left to anybody else. It's going to stand forever. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces, consume all these kingdoms. It shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest, the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. The dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So Daniel tells us now precisely what's going to happen. There's going to be four kingdoms. Babylon, Persia, Greece. Later on we're going to find it's Rome, although he doesn't name it there. In the days of the Roman Caesars, the God of heaven is going to set up his kingdom. It'll subdue all the other kingdoms of the entire world, and it'll stand forever. He's talking about you and me. He's talking about the kingdom of Jesus Christ, the church of our Lord. So he's predicting this back in 500 B.C. That came about 500 years later. You see, that's the reason Daniel's so important. It gives us a foundation to understand things that are going to come about later on. We have so much more to talk about, and I think I can't get too far this morning because of time, but we'll try to go a little bit farther in chapter 3 now and continue as far as we can that chapter so that we might continue today, perhaps bring our study in Daniel to a conclusion this day. I'm not sure we can do that. We'll try to if we possibly can. Chapter 3 continues on, and we find here that we have Nebuchadnezzar again on the scene. The king made an image of gold, and the height was 60 cubits. Now, a score is 20, and 60 would be 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. And so Nebuchadnezzar now sets this image up, and he requests and commands that everybody fall before it. Verse 6 says, whosoever falleth not down and worshipeth shall be the same hour cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So here Nebuchadnezzar, who was able to see the future and be assured that Daniel knew what he was talking about, recognized the fact that Daniel had the course of God in order to do this, he now goes astray, and he takes himself to the position of building an image himself and says, in effect, this is God. And so he wants everybody to bow before that image and commands they do so. Well, here we have Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the Bible says their names in Babylon language are concerned, and he says these refuse to do so. Now they tell the king in respect and not out of order at all, but they tell him we can't do that because we'll only serve our God. We'll serve no one else. So the king says, in effect, I'll give you one more chance, and if you don't bow before this image I have made, I'm going to throw you in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And so they say we can't do it. So they bound them hand and foot, and the fury of Nebuchadnezzar is so great, he allows the fire to be 7 times hotter than normal, He takes some of his mightiest men. He takes the three men of God. He throws them into that fire. And of course, naturally, they are to be burned up. But for some reason, Nebuchadnezzar looks in there and sees not only are they walking around in that fire that should have consumed some greater power than his, he calls them forth and he praises them and of course praises their God because that God had saved them from that burning fiery furnace that he had prepared for them. So chapter 3 tells us about these faithful men of God and the burning fiery furnace. We continue on now in chapter 4. We notice that Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell on all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. It appears now that he must have had second thoughts to say, now wait a minute, I have been approached by God twice, and I recognize who this is, and there is indeed a great God. We go further. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and first in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the king thoughts of my head and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore made I a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. So he dreams again. And he brings in all these men to interpret it. But the last Daniel came in, verse 4, 8, and whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and before him I told the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, master of the magician, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods, now all of a sudden we stop. He's been talking about the great God, now he talks about the gods, so he hasn't been converted at all. He still has the idea that there are gods many in the world, and he thinks that Daniel simply serves one of those gods. He says, you are, the spirit of the holy gods is in you, no secret troubleth thee. Tell me the vision of my dream that I have seen, interpretation thereof. So Daniel tells him that this that you're looking at and seeing is not good for you. It's something that I can explain and I will, but the fact is, it's not good. And it's not something you want to hear. But he goes on down now and finally the king says, well, I do want to know what it is. And then we continue on in verse 18. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof. For as much as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation. But thou art able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astounded for 1 hour. His thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. The tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof in all the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the birds of the field dwelt, beasts of the field dwelt, from whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong. Now let me stop here and mention that, as in several places in Daniel and Revelation, we're going to see images such as the tree, which really is talking not about a tree at all, but about Nebuchadnezzar. So we find symbols throughout these. Now I'll explain symbols later on, and what they mean and how beautiful they are, and how what use they have. But here we find, first of all, a symbol. He says, our king has grown and become strong, and thy greatness has grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one coming down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down, destroy it, yet leave the stump and the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass. In other words, to make it secure, that it won't be taken away. In the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, let his portion be with the beast of the field till 7 times pass over him. Now we're going to find that 7 times means 7 years. This is confirmed by historians who know what happened then, and they say it was 7 years. Josephus is a historian that tells us all this. He lived the time of Christ and mentions this being 7 years. Verse 24 says, this that happened in the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree that the Most High, which came upon thy Lord the king, they that shall drive thee from men, thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, And they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, until, he says, thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever his will. So here Nebuchadnezzar has learned his lesson yet. God says, in effect, I'm going to bring you to your knees. I'm going to let you act like an ox and eat grass, be wet with dew for 7 years until you become humble. And whereas thou commandest to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee. You're going to have it back again. After that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. So Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to have some evil days, some harmful days ahead of you, but you won't lose your kingdom. God's going to see fit that be the case. And then I want you to look at verse 30. Daniel goes on, and the king now has lived for a while with this understanding in mind. He says in verse 29, at the end of 12 months, so a year passes on, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, now look at his boasting, is not this great Babylon that I have built the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? So he's praising himself, takes glory in what's happened for himself. While the word was in his mouth, the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be of the beast of the field. And they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Now from this last verse we understand that God raises up kings and sets down kings. It's in his power to rule the world as he sees fit to, sometimes by secular kings around us. And so after those 7 years have passed, the Bible tells us then that Nebuchadnezzar does come back to his senses again. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes in heaven. Mine understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none shall stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? The same hour, same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned to me, and my counselors and my lord sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Now, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to obey. The problem is that if Nebuchadnezzar finally realized there was a God, and the God we believe in, the one God that created the world, apparently his children didn't learn it, as we'll see in the next chapter. But our time is gone for this morning, so we'll stop at chapter 5. And continue that this afternoon. You listen very, very well. We appreciate that. And should there be some questions that you want to ask, by all means feel free to, and we'll discuss those after our services are over. I realize that I have gone very fast this morning, and intended to, because these basically are stories that had to do with that time and that age and that era. Now later on, we're going to slow down. We're going to go in detail because we need to then, because it applies to us and the future from that time forward. But these are things that happened back at that time. But chapter 5 is an extremely interesting chapter that will give us a great deal of insight to knowing for a fact that the Bible is written by the hand of God, not by man, as some people accuse Daniel of being. Some people say that Daniel was so exact and so precise in what he said that nobody could have done those things that he did, wrote those things he wrote, saw those things he saw, unless he looked in the past. In other words, Daniel wrote after the fact, they say. We're going to find in chapter 5 that's not so. We're going to find in chapter 5 that Daniel knew ahead of time what worldly men find out centuries later. It had to be the power of God that caused Daniel to see those things. You've been very kind to listen this morning. We appreciate it so much. As we stand to sing this song of praise, should there be some way we might render to you a spiritual service, would you let your wish be known while we stand and while we sing?